From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, filmmaker Marcel Ophuls. He's best known for his 1970 documentary, The Sorrow and the Pity. We'll talk about his latest film called November Days. It's about life behind the Iron Curtain and the changes that have taken place in Europe since the fall of the Berlin Wall. Also, race, poverty, and the underclass. Sociologist Christopher Jenks says it's time to rethink social policy in light of the riots in Los Angeles. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a new biography of Eleanor Roosevelt. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. It's near launch time for the shuttle Endeavour. NASA managers have extended a hold on the countdown by 10 minutes. The spacecraft's first ever flight now may take off at 7:16 p.m. Eastern Time at the earliest. Low clouds over Cape Canaveral may prevent the launch, but NASA engineers are hopeful that the Endeavour will be able to blast off during its 48-minute launch window. The shuttle crew are prepared for a 7-day mission. Their tasks include the repair and rescue of a satellite. President Bush today expressed his dismay and outrage during his tour of the burnt-out neighborhoods of South Central Los Angeles. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Under unusually heavy security, Mr. Bush walked through the ruins of a shopping center and hosted a community meeting in the riot-torn area. His motorcade was jeered by angry residents in some sections of town. At a prayer service at the Mount Zion Baptist Church, the president talked about the need to strengthen family values and provide people with a stake in the American dream.
We saw the violence. We've seen the hatred. Now we've got to heal and see the love. Los Angeles is going to recover. This is a great city. This city is going to recover.
The president is also meeting with Korean and Latino community leaders. Mr. Bush repeated his pledge to deliver $600 million in relief assistance, but he has not promised new government programs. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Former Detroit Police Chief William Hart has been convicted of stealing more than $2.5 million from a police department secret service fund. Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
The jury returned the verdict on their eighth day of deliberations in the case against William Hart, who served as Detroit's chief of police for 16 years. They convicted the 67-year-old Hart of stealing $1.3 million in cash from a fund intended to finance top-secret narcotics operations. The jury also found him guilty of diverting another $1.3 million into dummy corporations set up by a former deputy police chief. Guilty verdicts were also returned on two counts of income tax fraud relating to the theft of that money. Hart's attorney said his client was disappointed with the verdict and that he'll appeal. Sentencing will take place in August. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
The U.S. Chamber of Commerce says increased optimism about the economy has pushed a key business confidence index to its highest level in 2 years. The index, measuring business executives' view of the economy, rose to 63.3 in April. That is up from a February reading of 59.1. A reading of 50 or above is viewed by the economists, or rather economists, as a signal that the economy is expanding. Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 6 points to end the day at 3363.37. Declines edged advances in active trading. This is NPR News. The chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee has called for an international investigation into murders allegedly ordered by Jonas Savimbi, the rebel Angolan leader financially backed by the U.S. Oklahoma Democrat David Boren made his call as two defectors from Savimbi's group, UNITA, arrived in Washington to discuss the deaths. Savimbi is accused of ordering the deaths of two high-ranking members of his group, but the leader blamed Miguel Nazal Puna, the group's secretary general. Puna has fled to Portugal along with the movement's foreign minister. Savimbi is running for the Angolan presidency. After weeks of anti-communist demonstrations, the Central Asian government of Tajikistan has given in to opposition demands. It's agreed to form a new ruling council and advisory board representing a number of Muslim and democratic groups. The state of emergency and all-night curfew were also lifted. NPR's Kathleen Hunt reports from Dushanbe.
Before leaving his refuge in the parliament today, hardline communist president Rahman Nabiev agreed to call a ceasefire and to dissolve his newly formed National Guard. He also ordered all forces in the republic be disarmed, a task that worries many here given the recent distribution of automatic weapons to hundreds of men on both sides and the potential unwillingness of many of them to hand them over. Though Nabiev still holds his position as president, the city is under the control of the Muslim and Democratic opposition, who've declared the formation of a revolutionary governing council. But so far, the long-running demonstration against Nabiev has shown no sign of packing up and leaving the central square as long as he has a role in the government. This is Kathleen Hunt in Dushanbe, Tajikistan.
Germany's public sector union leaders today accepted a new pay offer from the government. The action ends the 11-day public sector strike, the country's most severe. Union leaders had recommended workers accept an improved offer from employers of a 5.4% across-the-board wage hike. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. My guest, Marcel Ofels, directed one of the classic documentaries of our time, The Sorrow and the Pity. That controversial 1971 film about French collaboration with the Nazis during World War II was banned by French television for 9 years. It was about a subject that Ofels knew firsthand. His father, the German-Jewish film director Max Ofels, had taken the family out of Germany in 1933. They fled to Paris. In 1941, they had to leave France to again escape the Nazis. They ended up in Hollywood. As an adult, Marcel Ofels has gone back to France and Germany to explore the history of the Nazis in his documentaries. The Memory of Justice looked at the hypocrisies of the Nuremberg trials, and Hotel Terminus was about former Gestapo chief Klaus Barbie. It won an Academy Award. Ofels' new film, November Days, is a look at life in Eastern Europe since the fall of the Berlin Wall. A retrospective of Marcel Ofels' films is being featured at the Human Rights Watch Film Festival, which opens in New York this week. The idea for November Days didn't come from Ofels. He was asked to direct it for the BBC.
I never wanted to do any of these films. No, really. I never volunteer. I mean, it's like the army used to be in World War II. You know, the good advice that top sergeants used to give to you, never volunteer for anything. I'm not in the habit of volunteering for documentary films. For one thing, they're very strenuous and not particularly easy to make. And also the pay is not all that good.
So you don't choose your film projects?
Never.
Someone makes you do them?
Well, I have film projects that I want to do, but somehow it gets more difficult as the years go by. Also, you become typecast, and you're happy when somebody comes up with some sort of suggestion and money. And someone like the BBC that gives you work. And then it's once you're in the saddle that the project becomes your own and that you then try to lead the horse you want to, the way you want to lead it and get it to the finishing line.
In the beginning of your latest film, November Days, you ask a man on such a night, and this is the night, and we see people celebrating the collapse of the wall. We see the smiles, the tears, all the elation. And you ask a man, on such a night, does liberation also mean sex?
Right.
And I was so struck by that question. It really stayed with me through the whole film.
Well, good.
And I was very curious why you asked him that.
Well, I'll tell you. It's because I was very much aware of this being sent into Germany for this particular project by the English, and that one of the reasons they had thought of me is that I'm not a German, that I'm the son of a German Jew, and that we are French. And so it was very much in my mind that the first thing we should try to do is to impress on an international audience, on an English audience, French audience too eventually, that Germans, no matter what their past may be, are people like other people. And the best way to do that is to show that occasionally they screw.
Just as simple as that.
Sure. It also had to do with my French editor, who said, "Well, why do you want we want to show these people, you know, being so happy and drinking champagne and why all this euphoria about some wall coming down? After all, they're Germans, you know, the hereditary enemy." So this was a way of convincing him that he's wrong.
Well, there's another scene, and I think perhaps it's connected to that same sensibility, and you're talking to a young East German waiter and asking him how he's going to celebrate the wall, and he says, "I don't know. I don't know how to dance, or I feel shy and awkward." And I thought that really spoke volumes about him, but also volumes about the system that he lived under, that he seemed not to know or believe that he could express this real elation.
Yes, it's an inferiority complex, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's been, apparently it's been getting stronger and stronger since. I haven't really been back into that situation, but the feeling of inadequacy and the feeling of inequality and the arrogance of some of the West Germans who, because they have had the benefits of the free world for all these many years because when Hitler's downfall came, they happened to be on the right side of the fence. These differences have now become even greater. The East Germans feel shakier and shakier, and so that waiter really does indeed, I think, he must be about 16, 17, 18 years old, and he's only referring to rock music and how can you get on a dance floor with nice Berlin girls and try to make them, again we get to sex, when you really feel that inadequate because you haven't had these privileges of freedom.
And then you go on and it's painful to watch. The camera rests and you watch him just trying to do a kind of a soft shoe dance, and he looks so awkward. I found it very painful to watch.
Really?
Yeah. I felt
really?
For him somehow.
I think he's a fairly good dancer. Really? Oh, well.
Maybe I'm showing my age. I don't know.
No, well, I don't know how old you are, but the music, of course, is not rock, which is the music that he would dance to. The music is Fred Astaire, which is the music that I like. So that's very arbitrary, of course.
My guest today is Marcel Ofels, and he, of course, is the maker of a number of very famous documentaries, including The Sorrow and the Pity, Hotel Terminus, The Memory of Justice, and his latest documentary is called November Days, and it's a look at life behind the Iron Curtain and the changes underway in Europe since the fall of the Berlin Wall. In this latest film, you juxtapose present-day footage, interviews, with footage from a number of musicals. And there's even a point in this documentary where you burst into song and you sing, "It's wonderful, it's marvelous."
It's wonderful,
just like
it's marvelous, you should care for me.
Are you?
It's Gershwin. It's
yes.
One of his greatest tunes.
Well, I'm wondering how frustrated you are in trying to make a musical yourself as a filmmaker.
Well, I don't think musicals, it was always my ambition. I mean, basically I'm a song and dance man and comedy, and I was trained in that. I was an assistant director. I'm also my father's son, who didn't do nearly enough comedies because in real life he was the funniest man I ever met. But his specialty were more romantic movies because also he never always did what he wanted to do, which isn't really that important. But the thing about musical comedy, well, Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly, you can't do anymore. They aren't around anymore, and the audience for it isn't around anymore. Because rock music, I think, has, just as television has destroyed the landscape that great filmmaking art has to cope with. That has been, to a great extent, destroyed by sitcoms. Just in the same way, if jazz musicians were really candid in front of a microphone or when they're being interviewed, most of them would say that rock music and the synthesizer has destroyed Broadway and musicals and the basis of Broadway and musicals, which of course is jazz and black jazz, we don't really have the audience for that anymore. So that is sort of useless nostalgia. Has nothing to do with reality anymore.
Let me read something that you wrote in American Film, and this was back in 1985. And you said, documentaries are just not my favorite kind of movie watching. The fact is that I don't trust the little bastards. I don't trust the motives of those who think they are superior to fiction films. I don't trust their claim to have cornered the market on the truth. I don't trust their inordinately high and entirely undeserved status of bourgeois respectability. Most of all, I dislike the idea of the greatest of all popular art forms ever being shanghaied into the service of a cause. Any cause. When I read that, I thought, well, then how am I supposed to view Marcel Ophüls' films? Is he saying, don't trust me and don't trust what I'm saying in this film?
No, basically, I guess I'm saying don't trust the others.
Just trust you.
You know, my, I don't know why this reminds me of that. My father used to say, why should I go see the movies? Why should I go see other people's movies? If the movie's bad, I'm bored. If the movie's good, I'm jealous. I'm just listening to you just now. I thought, my God, yes, I would still subscribe to all of that. It's the idea that we should teach, that movies should teach. Howard Hughes, I think, once said something very wise. He said, "If you want to send a message, use Western Union."
I'm speaking with Marcel Ophüls, and his latest documentary is called November Days, and it's a look behind the Iron Curtain, and a film that is part of the 1992 Human Rights Watch Film Festival, which debuts in New York City on May 8th, and it's beginning a national tour. Marcel Ophüls also, of course, did The Sorrow and the Pity, Hotel Terminus, The Memory of Justice. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with filmmaker Marcel Ophüls. Is there a trick, have you found over the many years that you've been getting people to talk? Is there a trick to get people to talk to you?
Well, you get me to talk.
Yeah?
Is there a trick?
Well, for me, it does involve a certain amount of research.
Yes, of course.
And a lot of nodding. You can't see that, but I nod.
Yes, of course. Well, that's you see, you're supplying the part of the answer. I think the worst mistake that you can make, whether it's with an old Nazi or whether it's with a politician or with a university professor or with anybody, is to seem to be following some sort of script and not reacting to the last answer. Mm-hmm. I think the ideal interview is one where it becomes a conversation because you react to what people are telling you as they go along. That's one thing. And the other thing, of course, the thing to avoid is to be uninformed. In other words, if the person you're interviewing gets the feeling that you haven't been doing your homework, then she or he is not going to be terribly forthcoming.
Is there a way to get an old Nazi to talk, or a way to get someone to talk whose ideas you actually want to denounce, or whose ideas you want to expose?
Yes, well, it seems to be, I seem to be the specialist of that particular situation.
Yes.
And lately I didn't know the answer for a long time, and maybe I still don't know it. There is one thing, I think, which old Nazis, or even young Nazis, and I have in common for very, very different reasons. But we are interested in the past. And most people are not. And this gives us something to talk about. And it all one of the recipes, I don't know if it works every time, but one of the recipes is to announce who you are. One of the things is to make quite clear that I'm Jewish, that because I'm Jewish, I'm not likely to agree with anything he has to say. And make that quite clear from the beginning, and then you usually find that not only do they want to justify themselves, which is one way of talking, but at the end they would like to open a bottle of champagne and have a feast of reconciliation with you. It's that last part that I usually don't cooperate in.
Hmm.
But because that's off camera anyway, so why should you do it?
Well, are you working against this desire, whether it's an individual's desire or a nation's desire, to forget about the past? A kind of amnesia that can just sort of like a fog make the past disappear.
Yes, it's not a sense of mission. Because it's the nature of the work. If I'm going to be doing that kind of work, I have to constantly appeal to people's faulty, fragmentary memories, to their selective memory, and to try to make my own selection out of their own selective memory. Mm. My own, too, because I'm 64 years old and my own memory is getting bad. I got knocked over the head on the way back from Bolivia on the Barbie thing, and probably by some of the Bolivian goons on Copacabana Beach, and I haven't been the same since. I now need help in the editing room just to keep 120 hours of film together and repertory it and put it in cross-index it so that we can all shape our memories together.
Let me just make sure I understand what you just said. And you mentioned the fact of getting beaten up in Bolivia. Can you tell us what happened?
It wasn't in Bolivia. It was on the way back from Bolivia where we had been filming the South American episode of the film The Life and Times of Klaus Barbie. And Barbie's former friends, neighbors, and protectors, of course, knew about the film. And they were at that time not officially in power, but they were still the owners of Bolivian Airlines, and they were still in charge of much of the Secret Service and the goon squads and so forth. And after the filming itself was fairly easy. The hotel where we were filming, I understand, was full of microphones because Hugo Banzer, who was Barbie's main protector, owned the hotel, actually. So by the time I got back to Rio, I'd never been in Rio. I went there mostly because of Fred Astaire and flying down to Rio, and because it seemed a romantic place to be, and a weekend in Copacabana. I mean, I don't get down to South America very frequently. And by that time, the briefcase with all the documents and the names of the dissidents that I had been interviewing had disappeared. And the beach was there was nobody on the beach except somebody, some man selling grapes. And it was off-season. And I went surfing, you know, and the waves are very big on Copacabana Beach. And that's the last thing I remember. And I woke up with a bloody face on the Avenida in front of the Meridian Hotel about half an hour later. And some Brazilian kid was speaking to me in Portuguese and pointing to my face and saying that it was bloody. And then later on, 2 weeks later or 3 weeks later, I had a small operation, very harmless operation in Paris. And now I've got a sort of a hole in my head. And the assumption is, although we can't be sure, that these were indeed goons. It was Bannon, the Bolivian goons who hit me over the head. Anyway, the whole point, I guess, is that I do have this reputation now of being Mr. Memory, like the 39 steps of Hitchcock, Mr. Memory. And Mr. Memory has no memory.
That means that it's a memory you can't exactly trust because it comes
I have to shepherd it. I have to nurse it. I have to have people who work with me in the editing room, who do cross-indexing, which should be done anyway. Computers help. It's a matter of, you know, when you have 120 hours of interviews to deal with, it's mostly a feat of memory anyway. And now I have people whom I trust who help me along. But going to parties, for instance, is usually embarrassing because people I met 10 years before and so forth, I may not. Part of it, I suppose, is the aging process.
Your father left Germany in the 30s, before the war.
Yes, 33, the day after the Reichstag fire. In other words, the day after Hitler took over, practically.
Do you have any memories of Germany, of your childhood?
I remember leaving. I remember the kitchen floor when we were and the small car that drove us to the station was a two-seater and open. My father was always a very frivolous man. He always had, convertibles, very chic convertibles, and two-seaters. And I was back with the luggage, and we drove to the station and just got onto a Pullman, what do you call them, a wagon-lit sleeper to Paris. All he had to do was take his luggage along because being a genius, he didn't need to sell a lot of property.
So much of your documentaries have had to do with Germany, with certainly The Sorrow and the Pity, Hotel Terminus, The Memory of Justice. Do you think these films are in some way a memory to your own father and what he did and sort of where he came from and his leaving of Germany?
Yes. Yes, I think that's perfectly true. I think that's true. It's something that's not always understood because people have this idea that my father, because his specialty was costume films and so-called romantic films, and they're not really romantic, they're very realistic, but that he was somehow above politics. But obviously, leading the life that he did in the century that we live in and having the destiny that he had, he couldn't possibly be an intelligent man. He couldn't possibly be unpolitical. And at home, of course, we talked much more about politics than we ever talked about movies. We had good reason to. And it does have to do with the idea that being cosmopolitan, which is now supposed to be a bad thing to be again because of the rise of nationalism, that being a cosmopolitan gives you a view of other people's aspirations and other people's culture and a sort of distance to it, which might be something that can be used not only in a critical way, but also in a generous way. My father was a very generous man.
Marcel Ofel's latest documentary is called November Days. It will be shown as part of a retrospective of his films at the Human Rights Watch Film Festival, which opens this week in New York City. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen with Fresh Air. Coming up, a look at what was behind the anger in Los Angeles. The Bush administration is saying that President Johnson's war on poverty is to blame. Democrats are pointing a finger at the massive cuts of the 1980s. We'll talk to sociologist Christopher Jenks about rewriting social policy. Critic Maureen Cargan reviews Volume 1 of a new biography of Eleanor Roosevelt. It focuses on her life before she became First Lady. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush today went to some of the areas of Los Angeles hit hard by last week's rioting. As Mr. Bush traveled in a heavily protected motorcade, residents gathered on street corners. Kitty Feldy of station KLON reports from Los Angeles.
Outside the Mount Zion Missionary Baptist Church in South Central, dozens of people gathered to try to catch a glimpse of the president as he arrived for a prayer service. Those of an older generation, like Mary Wallace, expressed hopes that the presidential visit will make a difference.
I'm thankful that he come, because we really need somebody to help out over here. Because there's a lot of people that got burned up.
But younger people were skeptical and angry. 38-year-old Rodney White blamed Presidents Bush and Reagan for the violence because they slashed federal job training programs.
Make it better! He's going to make it better. And what he's going to do, he's going to do what he's been doing for the last 4 years, nothing but making it worse.
One young girl said the president has no idea what it's like to live in a neighborhood where just going to the market means dodging gang bullets. For National Public Radio, this is Kitty Feldy in Los Angeles.
Evidence gathered by the U.S. government continues to indicate that Iran was involved in the March bombing of the Israeli embassy in Argentina. 29 people died in the blast, and more than 250 others were wounded. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Islamic Jihad, which is supported by Iran, claimed responsibility for the bombing soon after it occurred, and the group authenticated its claim by releasing a videotape of the Israeli embassy taken before the blast. State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler said this afternoon, "Information gathered to date supports this claim." But the U.S. does not have final proof that Islamic Jihad set the bomb or that Iran helped it to do so. Iran has denied it. However, Reuters reported today that a senior State Department official says there are strong indications that Iranian diplomats helped plan the bombing and that Iranian embassies all over Latin America and elsewhere are collecting information on other possible targets for attack. The Buenos Aires bombing was believed to be Islamic Jihad's retaliation for Israel's killing of Sheikh Abbas Mousawi and members of his family a few weeks earlier in Lebanon. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
In Florida, NASA officials have delayed liftoff of the space shuttle Endeavour. After a delay caused by the weather and a computer problem, liftoff had been scheduled for 7:06 Eastern Time. The launch window for today closes less than 1/2 hour from now. 7 astronauts are on board the shuttle on a mission that is the 47th shuttle flight. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 6 points to close at 3,363.37 in very active trading. This is NPR News. In Moscow, Russian President Boris Yeltsin has signed papers calling for a Russian army and named himself as commander-in-chief. Last month, Russia's parliament approved separate armed forces for the nation. After the breakup of the Soviet Union, Yeltsin promised to keep Russia within a joint military command for the new Commonwealth and turned aside calls for a separate army. However, several other former Soviet republics have created their own armed forces. Officials have said that the new Russian army will have up to 1.5 million people. The Bush administration warned Russia yet again today that its $250 million contract to sell rocket engines to India could lead to trade penalties. NPR's Ann Garrels has this report.
India says it wants the rocket engines for its space program, but the Bush administration is concerned the rockets could be used to deliver bombs. The administration argues the sale would violate an agreement to limit the spread of missile technology. A senior U.S. official said he did not believe this single sale of rocket engines would make Washington halt aid to Moscow, though he did warn if there were a sustained program of evasion, this would not augur well for the future. Trade, it seems, is a different issue. The State Department spokeswoman told reporters to expect something about penalties or sanctions soon. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
In moves toward a free market economy, Russia has raised interest rates on savings accounts and freed the price of vodka. However, the government kept its control on vodka production. Earlier this week, the Russian government said it would let the Russian ruble trade freely against other foreign currencies beginning July 1st. Meanwhile, both education and healthcare workers are demanding more money. Last month, doctors and other medical workers began a campaign for better pay and working conditions. Hundreds of doctors in Russia are already refusing to work at outpatient clinics. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Last week's riots in South Central Los Angeles have touched off a debate about President Bush's domestic policy. Critics say that the Bush administration has no domestic agenda, that the problems of the inner city are largely the result of government neglect. President Bush's press secretary, Marlon Fitzwater, earlier this week said the social welfare programs of the 60s and 70s were responsible for the riots. We called sociologist Christopher Jenks to talk with him about tackling urban social problems. Jenks teaches at Northwestern University and is currently a visiting scholar at the Russell Sage Foundation. He's the author of the new book, Rethinking Social Policy, Race, Poverty, and the Underclass. Jenks said that when you look at the programs of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society that have survived, most of them are widely supported.
The big programs of the Great Society fall into really three groups. One is the educational programs, Head Start, the Pell Grants to help kids go to college, loan programs to help kids go to college, Upward Bound, the Job Corps, things like that, which I don't think either Fitzwater or anybody else thinks have exacerbated our problems. In fact, almost everybody approves of those kinds of programs that improve educational opportunity. Then there are a whole set of programs that have to do with improving health, although Medicaid is a very expensive program. I don't think anybody thinks that helping poor people go to the doctor and get hospital care is exacerbating the problems of the inner city. In fact, most people would probably say the opposite. And then the last set of programs are programs like the housing allowances and food stamps and so forth that help people whose income is too low to make ends meet to get food on their table and keep a roof over their heads and so forth. Those programs are a little more controversial, but again, they by and large are very few people have ever really tried to make a case that giving people rent vouchers so that they could move into a better house was somehow making them either poorer or more criminal or worse parents or any of that sort of thing. So it's really welfare that everybody's mad about.
What would you say has been the legacy of the Reagan administration and now the Bush administration when it comes to urban policy? Senator Patrick Moynihan was quoted as saying, you could be a U.S. senator for the last 3 years without knowing there was any Bush domestic agenda. Do you agree with his observation?
I think that's essentially correct. I mean, the Bush administration did have a group that got together to think about whether they should propose anything new to deal with the problems of persistent poverty in the United States, and that group essentially concluded that nothing should be proposed, but there was some talk about it, and it was decided that it was either politically not advantageous or that the programs were too costly or both. So I think basically Moynihan is right. The Reagan administration tried to scale back a lot of these programs, and the Bush administration has concentrated on doing other things and tried to ignore the whole problem.
President Bush is most recently quoted as saying he wants to give people a piece of the action. Can you translate that for us?
I think I would translate that into I would like to be on the side of poor people as long as it doesn't cost any money. Until you say what action you have in mind, those things don't mean much. Now, some of the Bush administration's initiatives seem to me not bad ideas. I mean, the effort to get more poor people's participation in public housing, for instance, seems to me a good thing to do. That's something that Jack Kemp has been interested in for a long time and has pushed, but has gotten only rather faint-hearted support from the White House on. If the explosion in Los Angeles sort of moves some of those Kemp initiatives to the top of the agenda, that would certainly be a good thing.
When talking about the needs of the urban poor today in the 90s, and these are people that weren't helped by either the New Deal or programs of the Great Society, do you think it's time to really redesign a whole new set of programs and policy aimed at the poor in cities today?
I think we do need a drastically new approach to some of these issues, not all of them, but some of them. And particularly, I think we need a new approach to the problem of helping single mothers who are trying to support their families. I mean, I think everybody hates the welfare system. Everybody's been cursing it for at least 30 years. And indeed, the programs that everybody talks about now to try to get more welfare mothers into the labor force were begun in 1967, was the first congressional set of programs to do this, which was in the heyday of the Great Society. And already we were trying to encourage more welfare mothers to acquire the skills they needed to go to work. But I think that whole that approach needs to be rethought, and we need to begin thinking about getting single mothers into the labor force, not just by relying on job training, which has very limited benefits, some but not great ones, and instead recognize that most single mothers could be working, but they can't support their families on what they can earn at the moment. $5 an hour is just not enough to support a mother and a couple of children, either in Los Angeles or in most other places. And we need to make sure that in addition to their earnings, these single mothers are getting child care and getting Medicare so that their medical bills are getting paid and getting the same kind of rent vouchers that welfare recipients often get, so that it pays to go to work. And we have to give up the idea that sort of once people go to work, we're going to abandon them to the free market, and somehow they'll be able to take care of themselves on minimum wage jobs.
I'm speaking with Christopher Jenks, and he's currently a visiting scholar at the Russell Sage Foundation. And he's just written a book called Rethinking Social Policy, Race, Poverty, and the Underclass. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Professor Christopher Jenks. What do you see as the proper role of the federal government in designing and implementing an urban policy? What role do you think they should play?
Well, it seems to me pretty clear from the history of the last 30 or 40 years that the federal government does have to take the lead in this. There was, I think, a certain amount of feeling during the last 12 years that somehow the states would be able to take a much larger role in the development of social policy. I think one thing we learned during the last 12 years is the states really can't do that. The main reason they can't do it is that the states are constantly in competition with each other to sort of have lower taxes than their next-door neighbors and to sort of try to lure industry from other places and so forth. So there's a kind of beggar-your-neighbor approach. So I think it's really got to be the case that if we're going to do anything in this area, the federal government's got to take the lead. Now, that doesn't mean the federal government has to take sole responsibility for it, but it's got to be the sort of architect that puts the pieces together, even if those pieces involve major roles for states and cities and even neighborhoods.
How much do you think a new urban policy should deal with the issue of crime and whether the choice is between increasing a police presence within the inner city or developing new kinds of policing that involves the community, and whether the issue of trying to preserve inner city communities is as important as education or jobs or any of those other issues we've talked about?
I think it's a hugely important issue, and I think the sense that this is out of control in a lot of these neighborhoods is palpable, and it's terrifying for a lot of people, and understandably so. The problem is that I don't think at this point anybody has any idea really what to do. I mean, it's not like the welfare problem where I think reasonable people could say, okay, they may disagree about what the right thing to do is, but there are a number of possible ways to go that would make significant improvements. So I think we have to be much more open-minded about trying out a lot of different things because everybody runs against crime. There's no disagreement between Democrats and Republicans or anybody else about that. And having run against crime for 100 years, we haven't figured out what the solution is.
How do you think programs, even policies, can be designed to address some of the more intangible parts of poverty, whether it's urban or rural or even suburban? And I'm talking about things like a sense of despair or a sense of alienation. And these feelings, I think, profoundly affect one's quality of life. Is it even possible to think about programs that can do that?
Well, obviously, man doesn't live by bread alone. He lives a lot on hope. And where hope comes from is always an elusive question. It's not easy to figure out how it is that you sort of instill hope in people who have lost it. But one thing that seems fairly clear is that we're on a track where over the last 20 years, the sort of growth in the economy has been very slow compared to earlier times. I mean, not the economy as a whole is growing because the population is growing, but the productivity of workers hasn't been going up in the way that we're used to. And that means there's less expectation that things are going to be better in the future for a very large proportion of the population. This is not just the poor. This is, if you look at the real incomes of people in the middle of the income distribution, they didn't improve during the 80s. The improvement was mostly sort of for people near the top. And that is demoralizing, there's no question. And it's especially so if your situation is really bad. I mean, people get discouraged and depressed.
I know that we've touched on this a little bit earlier, but perhaps I can even get you to summarize what it is you think should be done and if it's a matter of reviving the economy.
Well, clearly we need, the key to most things is a somewhat more rapid rate of economic growth. There's no question about that, because almost anything that one would like to do to help the poor is going to cost money, and then the question is going to arise, where is that money going to come from? And if we have a growing economy, that money is going to be a lot easier to find than if it has to come out of a relatively stagnant or even shrinking economy. So that's sort of central to a lot of this. If we could push up the rate of productivity growth to 2% a year from 1% a year, an awful lot of things would take care of themselves, some extent at least, as a result. That kind of growth, I would argue, requires a fairly substantial change in the way management deals with workers and that kind of thing, and that's not an easy thing to alter. It's not a matter of changing the interest rate or doing something just to reduce the federal deficit or that kind of thing. It really requires a change in habits of people who run organizations, and that in turn means changing the habits of the people who work in those organizations. So it's a slow process, but I think that can be done. Now, the other obvious thing is that when we start making social policy, we have to have policies that encourage people to behave in the ways that we approve of, and we've had a number of policies that didn't do that, of which sort of welfare is the
Do you think that what happened in Los Angeles last week will get politicians, will get the public to rethink social policy in a serious way?
I would be very surprised if that happened in the short run, because this is an election year, and rethinking anything in an election year is an incredibly difficult thing to do. In an election year, what people do is they trot out the familiar and say it'll solve whatever problem has come along, so that the Republicans will fall back on whatever they've been talking about and say there's the answer, and the Democrats will fall back on their familiar solutions. On the other hand, I do think that over the slightly longer run, this explosion may help get these issues sort of back on the agenda. A lot of that depends on what happens in November. It's hard for me to imagine that Republicans will want to make dealing with urban problems a sort of centerpiece of a second Bush administration. There's certainly no indication in the first one that that was a high priority for them. On the other hand, if Democrats win, I think, for better or for worse, it would be almost impossible for them to avoid trying to grapple with these issues in a major way. How well they'll do it remains to be seen, but I think they're likely to think they have to try.
Christopher Jenks, thank you for joining us on Fresh Air today.
Thank you.
Christopher Jenks is a visiting scholar at the Russell Sage Foundation and the author of Rethinking Social Policy. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Linda Wertheimer has joined us to tell us about the show today. More stories from Los Angeles, Linda?
Yes, Marty. As you know, the president has visited Los Angeles today. We'll have a report on that. We'll talk to a man who is trying to invest his own money and interest other people in investing theirs in rebuilding South Central Los Angeles. And we'll talk to some families in white suburbs about their fear of what happened, and black families who, because of their fear, are moving to the suburbs. We're also going to hear from two brothers who wrote a lot of songs that appeared in Disney movies. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious is their song.
Okay, Linda, thanks. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Most people know of Eleanor Roosevelt from her years as one of America's most active and involved first ladies. The first volume of a new biography of Roosevelt by historian and journalist Blanche Wiesen Cook explores some of the events of her early life. Critic Maureen Corrigan has this review.
During the autumn of 1918, Eleanor Roosevelt would drive almost daily out to Washington's Rock Creek Cemetery. There she'd sit for hours in a holly grove, looking at a hooded statue of a woman, a statue called Grief. The statue had been commissioned by the historian and writer Henry Adams in memory of his wife. Clover Adams had committed suicide by drinking photographic acid, evidently when she learned of Henry's affair with another woman. At the time of these graveyard visits, Eleanor Roosevelt was 34. She had five children and was married, of course, to FDR, who was then Assistant Secretary of the Navy. And she had just found out about Franklin's affair with Lucy Mercer. Whatever thoughts ran through Eleanor Roosevelt's mind as she stared at that statue remain a mystery. She never wrote about her private emotions for public consumption. All we do know is that these months of contemplation were crucial to Eleanor Roosevelt's emergence as the greatest American woman leader of the 20th century. For shortly after, she reclaimed the talents that had moldered during the early years of her marriage. She began writing, teaching, and working for reform movements, like the 48-hour work week for women. Eleanor also began to generate what would become a vast FBI file. J. Edgar Hoover kept close tabs on her starting in 1924 when she supported that un-American body, the League of Nations. And somehow, Eleanor and Franklin hammered out a different kind of marriage. There were no more secrets. FDR had other intimate relationships, and so did Eleanor. The first volume of Blanche Wiesen Cook's biography of Eleanor Roosevelt is, to use a quaint word we haven't heard much lately, inspirational. Those cemetery months were pivotal, but Eleanor Roosevelt kept transforming herself throughout her life. She was raised in an alcoholic, aristocratic family straight out of the novels of Edith Wharton. She attended a progressive all-women school where she discovered a love of learning and a gift for leadership. And decades later, she also found the courage to passionately love another woman, journalist Lorena Hickok. It makes perfect sense when Cook tells us that it was Eleanor who indirectly fed FDR that famous line, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." Cook's biography doesn't turn Eleanor Roosevelt into a saint, but it does rescue her from the self-deprecating image she herself created. Cook also pieces together the fullest picture to date of Eleanor's relationship with Hickok, as well as her intimate friendships with bodyguard Earl Miller and activist Nancy Cook. Their letters to and from Eleanor have disappeared, and biographer Cook thinks this strange silence speaks volumes about the close nature of their relationships. Some people have criticized this biography for making Eleanor Roosevelt into a feminist. But Eleanor herself used the word feminist, and from 1921 on, she was centrally engaged in women's political movements. What else would you call her? Volume 1 ends in 1933. Cook quotes Eleanor as saying that she was sincerely glad that FDR had been elected president. But she goes on to say, "Now I shall start to work out my own salvation as First Lady. I can hardly wait for Volume 2 to learn how she managed that."
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Our senior producer this week is Fred Landrell. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with Joan Tuohy and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Terry Gross returns tomorrow. I'm Marty Moscawain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Spalding Gray's latest monologue, Monster in a Box, is about all the distractions that prevented him from completing his novel. Now the monologue has been made into a film, it's also out in book form, and on top of that, his long-awaited novel has just been published. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Spalding Gray about his own personal Hall of Mirrors. I'm Terry Gross, I hope you'll join us.